Hello and welcome to Revision Media, revisionmedia.org. Paul Stevenson.
Are you with me, Guy?
Yes.
All right. For those of you who don't know, Mr. Guy DeMar, he is the founder of American Vision. How many books have you written, Guy? About 300?
Yeah, it seems that way. My wife will tell you it seems like I've written 300 because I'm always down here doing that. And I've written 35. Actually, the latest one is The Rapture and the Fig Tree Generation.
Right. All right. So, as I say, anyone, if you want to hear some impressive Christian apologetics and worldview stuff, go to AmericanVision.org and GuyDeMar.com, and presumably you can order your books from that website as well, Guy.
Yes, and for international people, we do have a lot of electronic versions of books, as I know. Postage is pretty expensive to ship it out of the United States, and who knows what the post office will do regarding this coronavirus? Will they even ship packages from the United States without quarantining them for 14 days?
Yeah, well, I mean, these are unprecedented times. They feel like they're very bizarre times. I'm not even sure how to process it myself. I guess on shows like this, we've always talked about the possibility of, you know, this type of thing happening without really thinking it's going to happen, I suppose. I mean, there's a lot of preppers out there who are going to be feeling very proud of themselves right now, but I'm not really sure what to make of it all. I mean, my own view is that I think perspective has been lost. I think there's a huge amount of fear been pumped out by the media. People are scared. I think it's also it's causing division as well, I think, as well. And no one seems to be really talking about the economy on this. I mean, suddenly overnight, you guys may as well have got Bernie Sanders in, and we may as well have got Jeremy Corbyn in over here, because we've all just become socialists, it would seem, overnight, Guy.
Yeah, well, people have called this socialism. It's really Keynesianism, but they essentially, because under socialism, the centralized government, you know, controls the means of production. They don't own the businesses like the industries, like communism does. But Keynesianism is what we're experiencing, is that is just a continual increase of the money supply, which you know dilutes the value of your money. So you pump $2 trillion of fake money into an economy, and it's like adding water to wine, but selling it as the real deal. And the long-term effects of that, of course, are increased prices. Now, right now, because people are out of jobs, and we're seeing prices relatively stable, although some prices are coming down. Gasoline here is really, really inexpensive. I don't know how to translate that into liters and so forth, but it's very, very cheap here. It's probably fallen, I would guess, 30%.
Similar about here.
Yeah. And so we're seeing the supply just dry up. And so the prices are dropping. You know, this is economics 101. When there isn't demand, the price drops. And that's what we're seeing today. I wish people would understand the nature of economics. And we might have a better economy long term if people understood this is the way things work. And what we have, unfortunately, is government stepping in here and trying to fix this and fix that. And they create one problem, and they come back with two or three problems, and then they try to fix those problems, and then the government gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah,
and people become more and more dependent upon the government.
Absolutely, and it's like the fire. It's like a fireman. They start the fire, and then they arrive with the fire engines to put out the fires that they started. It's like a drowning man swimming deeper to save himself. I mean, the analogies could go on, but I mean, what it has revealed is the fragility of everything, and also the artificiality, and I think the corrupt nature of the economy, because they've just been pumping, inflating this bubble even since 2008, and I mean, this thing is surely just going to implode.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. Donald Trump did a number of things here in the States that really helped the economy, and that is the decreased regulations, cut the tax rate, made it easier for American companies to come back to the United States and do business. What was happening here in the United States is that the Democrats were pushing, we need to tax corporations more and tax these companies, and the companies, it's not my saying, but I've always said that money is a coward. It's going to go where it feels it's much safer, and so we sent all these businesses overseas. And we've seen what happened with China, that much of our pharmaceutical business is over in China. And we've seen the electronics business.
Yeah, thanks to Larry Summers.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and so the fragility of the markets are the nature of the impacting that our governments do to the economy to mess things up for companies. And then a domino effect occurs.
Exactly.
And what Trump did early in his presidency, his first term, was to try to remedy that situation. And that is one of the reasons why the economy took off. Everybody's taxes were lowered, and as a result of that government revenues don't drop; they actually go up. I know it seems incongruous, but that's exactly what happens. What I would like to see in all this is that we get the government out of our lives at the economic level and regulations. It's amazing here in the United States, the trucking business. The government says, "Oh, we need to overturn this particular regulation. We need to overturn that regulation to make this move. So let the trucking industry move more smoothly." And my question is, why did we have those regulations in there in the first place? And it's usually because of some lobbying group wants to protect their industry, so they put political pressure on and money to get politicians to vote in order to protect their industry. And as a result of that, it hampers, the trucking industry.
Well, we've got it's bad enough over here at the best of times, in terms of the police state. I don't think you guys in America really quite understand what it's like over here in the UK. And because you have a culture which was sort of created, on liberty, and that's been gradually and been perniciously eaten away at too. But still, over here, I mean, the government's just always in your face. It's just like parking tickets, and you can't park here, and have you paid this charge, and fine for this, fine for that. And they are really already, we're seeing abuses over here.
Hello? Have we got a caller?
Oh, hello, yes. I just called to listen, John. Thanks very much. I couldn't get the stream to keep going, so sometimes I listen on the telephone. I didn't mean to interrupt you, fellas.
No, you're okay. You're okay. Go ahead. Do you have a question or a comment?
Not at the moment. I just got on continuing, but I'm enjoying listening to you, and I couldn't get the stream to keep going. So the easiest way for me to listen sometimes is to call the number, and play it that way. Please continue, and I apologize for the interruption.
No, it's okay. Is it free for you to call in?
Yes, it is.
And are you? Which part of the world are you in?
I'm in upstate South Carolina.
And are you doing well, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm okay. I had a bit of a scare yesterday. I thought I was having another stroke. I had a TIA, I guess. My left side and my left arm did not want to move for about, it seemed like hours. It was probably only about 10 minutes, but I'm much, much better today. I feel good today compared to that. Just very grateful to be here,
That's good. What's it like there with all this coronavirus stuff? It's interesting to hear.
They just issued us a stay in order. You're supposed to stay home. And I'm not going to stay home. I'm going to see my girl here in just a minute. She has supper for me ready, and she has paper. She she's been given papers because she's a nurse, and so she's what, an essential worker, you know. I mean, I think what they're trying to do to us is to divide us up into essential workers, essential slaves, and useless eaters. I mean, I believe that's the goal. I really do believe that's what they want to
do. Yeah, I think you're right, Stephen. I think that is the goal. They're going to separate us into those who they need and those who they don't need.
Exactly. And I have some friends over in your neck of the woods, too, on Facebook. I speak to regularly, and they say that it's much worse there. They have drones out telling them what to do. And even if they go for a walk in the park over there, I believe maybe it was Hyde Park. I'm not sure which park it was.
It's like that over here in Richmond Park, Hyde Park.
Yeah.
They're lowering the boom.
And they ran them off. They say, you can't be out here sunbathing, you know. That's just ridiculous. If you get out in the sun, the sun is good for you. It gets you vitamin D, you know. I mean, it's authoritarianism is what it is. It's that jackboot that wants to crush us. That's what's going on. Guaranteed.
These are the same police that apparently we've had, a shortage of police, and they can't deal with burglaries, but they can deal with, like, apparent hate crimes online. All of a sudden, we've got plenty of police, you know?
Exactly, yes. Well,
Are you on my Facebook, Stephen? Are you on my Facebook?
John Stevenson, is that it?
Edward Stevenson is my Facebook, if you want to give...
Stevenson. I will make sure I am. I do believe I am. I'm Stephen Douglas Whitener. I used to be a host here as well, and God willing, I'll participate with the roundtable here in a couple of hours too.
All right, cool. And maybe subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is Paul Stevenson with a V, Stevenson, because we've got to do everything we can to spread truth and fight back against this.
Yes, sir. I agree. We got to stand together. I agree with you completely, sir. Yes, and I will do that. I'll let you go.
Say hello on Facebook. It's Paul Edward Stevenson. And my YouTube is Paul Stevenson, Stevenson. It all helps, Stephen, you know?
All right, sir. I will do that as soon as I get out of the shower.
All right, cool. I'll play the video again. I'll get back online. Okay.
All right. I'm going to mute myself and enjoy the rest of your show. I may pop back in after I'm all finished. Thank you very much for being on. Hey, listen, thank you very much for being on Revision Media, too. We really need to get the word out, and I feel like this is more important now than it's ever been
We're in the final chapter here with the fucking everything that we dreaded, you know?
I agree. Yes, sir, I agree.
All right.
Keep up the good fight, sir. I will talk with you again in a bit. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Of the police state. I mean, I don't know, but it's kind of infamous now over here, where there was a clip of a drone shaming a couple out walking their dog in the middle of nowhere. They took their car out to the middle of nowhere. They had a drone there. We've got hotlines. We have a hotline set up here, so you can snitch on people if they're maybe going out. You know, your neighbor decides you're going out.
They're doing that here too. I think one of the, I don't know, the mayors of a particular city is, paying people if they snitch on people because they're violating, this distancing, regulation. But they've got the walking trails and the bike trails here in our county shut down. They've got barriers up, and I would go out and walk, periodically, and I'm never 20 feet from anyone. A lot of this stuff, I think, is baseless, but there are a couple of things operating here, and it's probably the same over there as well. We live in a very political culture, especially here right now, because the Democrats hate Donald Trump. I mean, they literally hate him, and they want to do everything to get rid of him, and they've tried for three years, and they haven't done it. And they see every opportunity to separate him from his voting base. And they're trying to do that here right now. And so they put these roadblocks up and blaming him for this and blaming him for that. And so this whole thing has become political. And so the safe thing for governors to do and mayors to do is to put in these draconian laws to protect their political hide in case something, something goes wrong. I went to a big, big box store here, Walmart, And now it's like the TSA at our airport. You got to go through these lines and so forth in order to get in. And then you can only go into one entrance because in some places here in the United States, they're blocking off so-called non-essential commodities.
Yeah.
So you can go in and buy food, but you can't go into these other places and buy anything because they're considered non-essential. And I just think that's just plain crazy.
Yeah, there was a clip up here where you saw these police, you know, the imagery as well. You had this stone-faced woman driving the car, of course. The woman behind the wheel, it just epitomizes our kind of culture in so many ways. And the policeman in the passenger seat. And they were on the bike harassing people and said, oh, we're just here to educate them. And I said, what would you know about anything, mate? You've probably never read two books in your life. You can barely string a sentence together and you think you need to be educating people. I mean, it's difficult to swallow, you know?
Yeah, and of course, a lot of people are fearful of all this. Look, but we have to admit that this particular virus is very impacting, especially on the elderly. Of course, I'm considered elderly. I'm going to be 70 years old in a couple of days. But underlying a lot of the people who are dying as a result of this are conditions that they've had. Some of them have been cancer patients who have their immune systems have been compromised and so forth. So I understand this is a deadly thing for a lot of people, but there are a number of epicenters around here as to where this is taking place. New York City is a good example of that, and you can understand it. It's more probably like London, very dense.
Yeah, it's the same here. We've got it worse in London than anywhere else because of international travel and density of the population. Yeah.
And we have 50 states, but West Virginia, for example, I think it only has one death as the result of this. And now, if you look at the statistics on flu in general, I mean, it's amazing how many people die as a result of flu every year. I mean, it's just staggering.
Half a million.
Yeah. I mean, it's and again, but this is a little different because I think the politics of it have been pushed on it for so long because we have a political party here that just anything President Trump does is something that they want to be able to do. We got Nancy Pelosi, who's the Speaker of the House, that she's now she's setting up a House Select Committee on the coronavirus crisis. And so now what she wants to do, of course, is kind of take this thing over. Tell me about it. So you've got your strange political foes as well. So you kind of know what that's like.
Yeah, we've got the technocracy into overdrive over here. We had some deputy chief medical officer, whatever her name is, I'd never heard of her 3 weeks ago, telling us the other day that, this could go on for six months and, maybe, hopefully. And it's just like, who the hell are you? I mean, it's just like, get off my screen. I don't even know who you are. And you're telling me as if you own the country,
Yeah, they've shut down the schools here in Georgia. I just heard today that schools will not reopen until the fall.
Every cloud for the education. You'd probably learn more being kept at home.
Yeah, well, I've got I have nine grandchildren, and I know the five of them live very close, just right up the street. And the school has set something up through, I think it's called Google Classroom, where they can the teachers can actually teach and the curriculum. But we have a very large homeschool movement here in the United States. And so parents have been teaching their kids at home for years. When our two sons were younger, for a few years, we taught them at home. And we know lots of people who teach their children at home, and they get a very, very good education. Now, I realize that a lot of parents both parents work, that's a very hard thing to do. But again, now we're back to, why do both parents work? Oftentimes, the two parents have to work in order to pay the taxes that they have. So there's a lot of changes taking place. I think some things are good, and some things are bad because people are getting used to the state telling them what to do and show your papers and you can't go here and you can't go there.
Creating the new normal. I've heard that phrase being used. The new normal.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's scary. And I made a comment on Facebook about people asking, what do I think about what's going on here? And I said, well, what we really need to think about is what will take place after this crisis is over and what the government will implement. Because this phrase of, you know, never let a crisis go to waste.
Quite.
And that's what the political end of things is trying to do.
Yeah, there was someone else who I forget who said it, but there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you think about it. I mean, I think we still have, it may be gone right now, but I think there were things that were put in place during our Civil War in the mid-19th century that were still operating in our country. And we were money was going to it. That's always the rub right there, is the money that goes to all these things.
But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's a mixed bag, really, because, you know, I can obviously, being a Christian, we want to promote the Christian worldview, and we'll get to where God is in this. But immediately you're seeing a threat to globalism and how fragile that is. It reveals the farce that is the EU, because they couldn't care less about Italy and everything else, because everyone's actually recognizing that they're a separate nation and they've shut their borders. We haven't recognized borders in Europe for a long time now. So there could be some, you know, is it Hegel, the cunning of reason at work here? You know, these, you know, it could backfire, because there is a huge sort of shakeup going on here to in so many areas, you know.
Yeah, of course, you've got some people think is what we need is a global government, and you know, here we got mayors of cities who can't handle anything, and governors of states know how big a job this is, and then all of a sudden to turn it over to some centralized bureaucracy, worldwide centralized bureaucracy. I mean, now you're talking about a police state, where people are going to have to come in and force you to comply, and they've done that here too. They've actually arrested a minister of a church in Florida because he held a service on Sunday, and yet he followed all the regulations regarding distancing and crowds and so forth. You know, people were supposed to stay so many feet apart and so forth and so on. And so people are, you know, they're a little concerned, you know, about all this. But at the same time, there's the fear factor of they don't want to get sick. They don't want to die. And so they tend to comply with these new regulations that they've implemented.
Yeah, I mean, I think the church is going to have to show some testicular fortitude on this issue, because we have another King, one Jesus, and you know, we are in the West. We've been so blessed, in quotes, although I think a lot of those blessings have become idols and have brought this sort of situation upon us. But you know, we have another King, one Jesus, and this type of stuff has been the norm for Christians and historically, persecution, and it is going to separate the men from the boys, I think, because we can't just let the state continuously dictate to the church, because Christians need to congregate.
Oh, absolutely. But at the same time, you know, technology has, in fact, made it easier. Our church, my wife and I sit down at 11 o'clock. We get my iPad out, and we can see it live. In fact, I just got every day we get something from our pastors, you know, giving us an update on things and if anybody needs anything. So the church really is still functioning. But what's interesting about all this is if you go back through the history, Martin Luther actually wrote on the church's response to plagues, and you know, and if you read it, it's very up to date. You know, we should take every precaution necessary, even fumigating. He goes on this whole list of things, very rational, thing to do. And as you know, I'm sure most of your listeners know, I mean, we've had plagues a whole lot more serious than what's going on today. I mean, we've had real plagues where tens of millions of people have died. I mean, Europe especially, you know, the Black Plague. And so people, I mean, people are, what we're experiencing today is minor compared to what they're experiencing. And then John Perkins is another person who wrote on this, what is the response to this sort of thing? And, you know, it's very modern and up to date about, you know, sometimes the magistrate, it's proper for the magistrate to deal with this because people didn't know how people got sick by, you know, bacterial infections or viruses and so forth. But they did know close quarters, getting close to people, you know, transmitted these particular diseases. And so they weren't stupid. They didn't know how to beat the virus or beat the disease, but they understood how they spread. And the idea of even the word quarantine was coined by those in Venice, and they would ship, they got news that there was some sort of disease that had affected those coming to shore from ships. Those ships had to stay out in the water for 40 days, and many believe it was that 40 day number. It's rather arbitrary, but it was from a biblical, you know, 40 days and 40 nights, Jesus in the wilderness and so forth. So there is a big history behind all of this. What we're experiencing today is not new, except in the fact that we have ways to beat it that our ancestors did not.
Yeah, indeed. And I've tried to avoid it, but, you know, and this is, you know, something that you're well qualified to talk about. This is by many seen as the Great Tribulation and all the rest of it, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. People do mention that. The Matthew chapter 24 and Luke 21, Mark 13. A lot of people think that's dealing with the end times, and people thought it during the plague times and Lisbon in 1753 when the earthquake and the tsunami hit Lisbon. I mean, nearly every generation can find something within their generational time span that they say is an indication of what we're living in the last days. We published a book a number of years ago called The Day and the Hour, which was a history of all of these examples of people making prophetic announcements regarding the end based upon wars and rumors of wars and famines and so forth. Now, Matthew doesn't mention pestilence, but Luke mentions pestilence. Both mention famines. But if you study that particular, those passages, Jesus is not describing what's going to take place around the world in some distant time. He was describing things that were going to take place to that particular generation. In fact, Matthew chapter 24 and Luke 21, you could escape some of the things mentioned in the Olivet Discourse by simply going to the mountains of Judea, which is obviously not something that was worldwide. And there were wars and rumors of wars that were mentioned that took place during that period of time. There was pestilence that took place. I mean, the history books of the era, of that area, and of that time give mention of all that. In fact, if you go to Acts chapter 11, there was a famine, it says, all over the world. Well, the Greek word there is oikoumene, which means over the political boundaries of the Roman Empire. So, but again, sensationalism sells, just like fear sells, sensationalism sells. And we've been hearing this for a very, very long time, that we're living in the last days. I see more and more stuff on Facebook about the Antichrist and the tribulation period and the rapture of the church, and we're the last days of the last days of the last day of the last days, as some Jehovah's Witness presented it. Now, this isn't anything new. People have been predicting the rapture or the end of the world for centuries, using the same Bible verses and the same types of worldly conditions that we're seeing around the world today.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is something I'd be interested in, you know, just apart from, you know, our listeners, just personally. Steve Gregg, for example, you know, I came across him and yourself around a similar time when I was looking at the scriptures thinking, how can this be extrapolated as talking about some future generation, you know, in terms of like going, you know, 2,000 years in the future. And, you know, so he would consider himself a partial preterist. But I've also heard him, and he doesn't use the word heretic lightly, but he thinks like full preterism is a heresy. And I that's one of the few things I disagree with him probably on, because the same exegesis and the same hermeneutics that you can end up being a partial preterist can also take you to being a full preterist. I mean, there's a guy called, what's his name, Don Preston.
Right.
Now, some of the stuff that he talks about, the corporate collective resurrection, I find a bit disconcerting. But, you know, do you think full preterism is a heresy? And I mean, would you consider yourself a full preterist or a partial preterist?
Well, you know, this is the thing that the creeds and confessions and so forth and would consider full preterism to be a heresy. And there are different types of full preterism, as you mentioned. You know, but these guys, they're trying to make an exegetical case. The church really has never sat down and dealt with the eschatology like they've done with other things. With the Westminster Confession of Faith, for example, which is the one that my denomination subscribes to, and there's a Baptist Confession of Faith, which is comparable, but on changes on the issues of church government and the sacrament of baptism, you really couldn't even be a partial preterist. You're based upon that. Because a lot of the passages, a lot of the scripture passages that the Westminster Confession of Faith uses to defend its eschatological position, we would see that as, oh, no, that refers to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The Westminster Confession of Faith said that it was the papacy that was the Antichrist, the man of sin. The papacy was the Antichrist. In fact, there are a lot of people who still believe that today. They consider themselves historicists, and they said, "Oh well, the reformers believe that the papacy was the Antichrist." The one thing that's right about is that an Antichrist is a religious figure, not a political figure. But I don't believe the papacy is the Antichrist. I was raised Roman Catholic, and we said the Apostles' Creed. That's where I learned the Apostles' Creed.
So was I.
Was in the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, they believe in the basic assessments of the triune nature of God and other things. I think they're wrong on so many other things, but that's neither here nor there. If you look at John's definition of Antichrist, there were many Antichrists, and John said in 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, this was evidence that this was the last hour. Now, the last hour of what? Well, the last hour leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem that Jesus said would take place before their generation passed away. And I believe that the Antichrist that John is describing were apostate Jews who denied that Jesus Christ had come in the flesh, because that is, in fact, the biblical definition of Antichrist.
Yeah.
So,
when I first studied this stuff, I remember going through it, when I first read the Bible, I was expecting to see the Antichrist in every other chapter or something. And it was just like, where is it? It's only mentioned four times, and I think two or three of them are plural.
Yeah, the only books of the Bible that deal with the Antichrist or with Antichrist is 1 John, 1 John chapter 2, 1 John chapter 4, and 2 John, verse 7. Those are the only places where the term Antichrist is used, and in those places, it's the Antichrist is defined for us: someone who denies the Father and the Son. That is, that there is an ontological relationship between the Father and the Son, and that would be Jews. That would be Muslims today as well. Anybody who denies the triune nature of God would be considered an Antichrist. But John had a particular group, and that was Jews living at that particular time, those who denied that Jesus Christ had come in the flesh. And that's the biblical definition of Antichrist. And what has happened is that people
anytime they see a bad guy in the Bible, they take that bad guy and they, it's like a piece of clay, and they you know, combine it with the other piece of clay. And so the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2 is this end time Antichrist. The little horn out of Daniel is the Antichrist. Of course, the two beasts in the book of Revelation are the Antichrists, and the Antichrist is the Antichrist. So anytime there's a bad guy in the Bible, in this, they create a composite Antichrist. And what I find interesting is that when I read books of people defending this particular view, they skip over the definition of the biblical definition of Antichrist.
Yeah,
exactly. Kind of like, well, here are the passages. Da, 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 da. Now let me tell you about the Antichrist. And if they actually did exegesis on those passages, they could never come to the conclusion that they did.
Yeah, well, they don't want their listeners or their readers to do too much thinking, do they? They want to come across as authoritative and just sort of skim over that and let me tell you about all this sort of stuff, and don't do any reading yourself. And if you do any reading and you think it disagrees with what we're saying, which is actually the intuitive way of understanding it, then just ignore that, because you're not smart enough to understand that, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just like this virus thing. Sensationalism sells. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. As a famous saying about you want to sell newspapers. You know, the whatever is above the fold on the first page of a newspaper is what sells the newspaper. And so the bloodier the headline, the more papers you sell. And it's the same thing with books about prophecy. My books on Bible prophecy, they sell okay, but they don't sell well because they're dealing with prophecy that has already been fulfilled. Man, you write a book about telling people what prophecy is going to be fulfilled, like Hal Lindsey did in the 1970s and sold 27 million copies of The Late Great Planet Earth. Of course, it's like the difference between, you know, me telling you that, hey, I bought this great stock and made, $50,000. And said, well, that's really great, but can you tell me what stock I should buy for me to make $50,000 in the future? Me telling you that I'm writing a book about how I made a fortune, buying and selling stocks is not going to sell as well as me writing a book telling you how you can make a fortune buying and selling stocks. So Bible prophecy is all about the future and people speculating on it, and then telling people, well, you're not going to go through all this mess. The rapture is going to come and take you out of here.
Yeah, exactly. And I mentioned the Antichrist expecting to see it everywhere. Well, at least it did make an appearance when I read it, because I'm still looking to this day for the prophecies about Israel being returned to that land in the New Testament. I still haven't found them. As I said, at least the Antichrist did make an appearance in there four times. The prophecies about Israel being returned to that land, I haven't found them yet.
Yeah, I go through this with people all the time. I say, show me one verse in the Bible where it says Israel is going to return to the land. And, they don't find one. And they'll go to the Old Testament about Israel returning to the land. I said, well, yeah, the Old Testament does predict that Israel will return to the land. And guess what? After the exile, when they came back, they returned to the land. And guess what they also did? They rebuilt the city of Jerusalem. And you know what else they did? They built the temple, rebuilt the temple. So what you need to do is you need to find a verse that says the temple is going to be rebuilt again. And there isn't a verse that says that.